Good morning. We're glad you're here. It's going to be a great day.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Hey, have you ever had that good advice given to you over your life over and over again and thought, okay, today's the day I'm going to finally take it? Well, do you regret it? Or is it a relief to you? We're talking about that in 20 minutes.
Imagine a gift you intended to give that you forgot about. And then 35 years later was worth $660,000. I'll tell you about how this happened to one individual coming up in your morning buzz.
Welcome to the day and to the week. If no one else has said it before, I'm going to gently lead you into, you know, whatever will happen.
Please be gentle.
7 days.
Please be gentle. For this week, I need you to be very delicate, if you wouldn't mind.
And I want to turn your attention to something good.
Tell me something good.
Now, today's Tell Me Something Good. A good way to start the week is with a feel-good story about a little kid, which will always, you know, always gets me in the feels, right? So this little kid, he's 3 years old and he starts school. He's got autism. He's still in diapers. Imagine how he must feel, just overwhelmed. His mother had two other children and their introduction into school was much different. And she was noticeably concerned about what will happen to her son, Amos, and especially in dealing with autism, about finding friends, because that can be a huge challenge. So with this mother heart introducing her son into school, she was so relieved when the coolest guy in the school, which was the custodian at Eddington's White Oak Elementary, Raymond Brown, started giving him some cool attention and started calling her son Famous Amos.
There you go.
Around school, and made it cool to be friends with Amos, right? Because when the coolest guy in the elementary school gives you a nickname, well, guess what? Everyone's like, hey, we got to know this kid.
Yeah.
Hey, who is this? And it helped him to be able to create a lot of friends. Had a huge impact on not only his introduction into school, but how the rest of his elementary school experience went. Mm-hmm. So this mom, Adrian Wood, she wanted to honor, obviously, Raymond Brown, you know, to say, you've gone above and beyond your job as head custodian here. You're really changing kids' lives like this and creating this wonderful inclusion. So she nominated him for this big award, which he didn't get.
Oh, no.
I know. For this North Carolina Heroes Award. And she said, you know, usually I'm not a competitive person and I don't really care about these kinds of awards, but I cried because I wanted him to win so bad. So what I love about this story is that Adrian didn't stop there. You know, she said, okay, then I'm going to take it upon myself to make a big deal about this. She goes to her Facebook blog. She raises $35,000
wow.
from nearly 2,000 people across the world for this hero. And she just created this environment to shower Brown with, you know, the praise and the money that he deserves. So it was a surprise ceremony. It coincided with Brown and his wife's 38th wedding anniversary, which I thought was really cool. She invited the mayor, the chief of police, Miss North Carolina. I mean, it was a big deal. They presented him, this beloved custodian, with $35,000 honorarium. They dubbed him and dubbed this award the Famous Amos Award. And everybody just had the good feel goods because of this. And I love that Wood, when they said, hey, so what do you think about this award? And he said, you know, I just hope everybody will look around and see it's not hard to do. It's not hard to be kind and to recognize that kindness. And when asked, you know, what Amos, this little kid, you know, really felt about it, he just simply said, I love you, Mr. Brown. And knowing that we don't get we don't stop when we do this kindness. We don't do it for awards. People don't do it for that kind of recognition. But you know what? It is nice every once in a while to do that, because it's a signal to other people to, hey, am I doing this in my life? Is this something that I've incorporated in? Oh, it just gave me all the good feelings. So that's your Tell Me Something Good.
Addiction is one of the most difficult things anyone has to go through. And what can be just as challenging is watching your spouse struggle through it. One addiction that can be extremely difficult on a couple is pornography addiction. A pornography or sex addiction can leave one's partners feeling hurt, denied, even betrayed, leading to the end of the relationship. But is it possible to work through a pornography addiction with your partner to change and to progress together? Well, today we're talking with licensed sex addiction counselor Debbie McRae, who specializes in helping women who've experienced trauma as a result of their partner's sexual and pornography addictions. And she believes these relationships can succeed if they learn to become pro-dependent, a word that we're going to be talking about in depth today. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
In what specific ways is the betrayed partner traumatized or really affected by sex or porn addicts' behavior?
That is such a wonderful question, because oftentimes we don't expect the betrayed partner to have the problem. Obviously, it's the addicted spouse. And one of the best ways for me to kind of give you an idea of what a life is like for somebody who's the betrayed partner, you know, the sex addicts are so good at lying that they can convince the partners that the sky is not blue, and that the partner's crazy for thinking that it is. So there's so much confusion. And there's this trauma that occurs because the relationship itself has had this severe disconnection take place as a result of their spouse's compulsive sexual behaviors, whether it's with porn or sex addiction, or if they've got a problematic sexual behavior. And so we see all these aspects in this partner's life that's affected from emotionally. They come in and see me asking, you know, why does it hurt so much? Why does my heart hurt? To spiritually, you know, they're questioning if they're good enough. Socially, they're looking at it like, gosh, what are others going to think of me if I stay with this partner? What if this gets out? What if I even go out in public with my partner? Can I even trust that they're not going to be triggered back into their addiction? Physically, they're affected because they're often questioning their own body and what it looks like and how their partner views it, because their partner's been viewing images that are unrealistic. And then, of course, sexually, I hear women come in and question with me, gosh, well, maybe I wasn't sexy enough. If only I had been, maybe my partner wouldn't be acting out. And then, of course, one area we don't think of being affected is financially. I've had women come in and find out that their husbands have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this addiction that they weren't even aware of. So we see there are so many different dimensions of a betrayed partner's life that's affected adversely by the addicted spouse.
So it's already it's something that is eye-opening to me, because so often when we have this conversation, we deal with addressing with the needs of the addict, and you're saying equally as important, if this is going to be successful, that the partner in that relationship also be able to receive treatment and therapy, although those things may look different, equally as important.
Absolutely, because you've got to remember that the betrayed partner, when either disclosure or discovery happens, whether it's for the first time or even repeatedly, they go into an emotional free fall. There's this damage that occurs, and sometimes repeatedly. And so it's so important, if we're going to have this relationship survive, we've got to approach it from both angles, not only with the sex addict and helping them through their addiction, but the partner helping them through their betrayal, through the shock, the anger, the denial, the grief, and even the symptoms that appear like PTSD, and some of them actually do experience PTSD as a result.
So when we talk about therapy and solutions to this trauma, at the beginning of the conversation, we introduced that word pro-dependent. What is pro-dependency, and how is it different from interdependency or codependency?
That's a wonderful question, and I'm very passionate about this subject, not only on a personal but a professional level. So just to give you a really brief background, Dr. Rob Weiss, he is the licensed clinical social worker who came up with this strength-based, attachment-focused approach to understanding addiction and those affected by their loved ones' addictions. So it's not another label like codependency or diagnosis, but it operates under the premise that all of us are wired to love people, to connect with people, and that we're only as healthy as our most stable connections. So when we have this sexual betrayal, all of a sudden there's this severe disconnection, this attachment wound, that all of a sudden now the partner comes in and it is so overwhelming, right? The circumstances they just get caught up in exceeds their ability to really healthily cope with their partner's addiction. And so the betrayed partner goes into crisis. So with the pro-dependence approach, we're looking at it from the angle of that the partner isn't flawed, the betrayed partner isn't somehow doing it wrong, but it's through their desire to really help the addict and to keep this connection, to create safety and security, that they go in and they attempt oftentimes in ways that aren't the healthiest to create a connection. And so one of the things I see is these partners going into something that we call safety-seeking behaviors. So it might look like partners get really angry. Partners might go through their spouses, their addicted spouses' phones or their computers. They mm-hmm. might follow their spouses to make sure they're going where they say they're going. But again, these are loving attempts to create connection. So we don't put any blame or shame on the betrayed partner. We don't pathologize their behaviors. And so oftentimes when I've got a client come in, what I'll say to them is I'll say, hey, let's look at all of the efforts that you've made to create safety and connection. And now I'm wondering if we could look at it another way, would there be a more effective way to do this and to support not only yourself, but your addicted loved one?
We're visiting with Debbie McRae, who is a licensed psychotherapist, about pro-dependency, the idea of attachment theory, and especially about addiction and sort of the trauma that exists for the partner, not necessarily the addict, but the partner of the addict. We lose a lot of otherwise really good relationships because people can't seem to navigate their way through an addiction. What have we learned in the most recent past that is helping us to have more successful relationships to support each other through addiction? Or are we getting better at it?
I believe that we are getting better at it because we are kind of expanding the view of how we look at it. You had mentioned earlier, you know, the codependency approach is something that came about in the 1980s, and now we're kind of shifting into more of, like you had mentioned earlier, this attachment-focused approach. So with codependency, you know, in the past, we were pointing to the partner and saying, hey, there's something wrong with you. You know, what are you doing wrong? Do you have trauma? Is this why you've chosen to be in relationship with a partner? And now we're kind of shifting into kind of a different way of looking at it, a different lens, so to speak. So we're looking at, you know, this is could be a relatively healthy person who is just dealing with a really abnormal situation. And so we're looking at it, and the message, the pro-dependence message is, hey, you're making these loving attempts to create connection, and let's see what you're doing and if there's a better way. And so we treat the person not as if they've got this pathology, but maybe they're just in crisis, and we need to help them stabilize through this crisis, which typically takes 3 to 12 months before we go in and go deeper to see, okay, maybe there's something more underneath this. So I think that's one of the biggest shifts that I'm seeing in that realm of helping the betrayed partner heal.
So if you don't mind getting a little bit more into the specifics of what this really looks like, what might that healing journey of that partner using the pro-dependency approach look like in practical terms?
Yeah. So let me just kind of put it in terms of when I first see a partner.
Okay.
You know, I'll see a partner and they'll come in to my office and they literally are in such fight, flight, or freeze in the moment, right? It's like they're crying. They can't regulate their emotions. You can really tell that they're in crisis. And so the next step that I'm going to do with them is I'm going to acknowledge, first of all, and let them understand that they are in crisis and that it's going to last several months, even up to a year, depending on how quickly we can kind of get them regulated and grounded. So we kind of have to stop the bleed, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And with that, I mean, I've got to teach them grounding exercises and tools, things how that they can manage just day-to-day life. So part of that, too, is I educate them. I teach them about how their brain is working, because right now they're operating out of that part of their brain that we call the limbic system, which is our fight, flight, or freeze response. And as long as you're in that part of your brain, we're not connected to the higher functioning part of our brain, which is the prefrontal cortex, where there's logic and reasoning and emotional regulation. And so I spend a lot of time in the very beginning stages teaching the partner how to regulate, how to do good self-care. You know, I validate them for what they are doing. And then maybe we go back in and see if there's some healthier ways to do it. And then from there, because I work at a facility, Family Strategies Counseling Center, we have a program that we can put them into if we feel like they need to go through some various different phases for healing. But initially, I want to get them stabilized. I want to get them to where they're feeling more grounded, not like life is, you're going from one crisis to the next.
So often within the conversation around this, when we learn about addiction and for whatever reason, specifically about porn or sex addiction, we hear statements like, well, if I ever found out my partner was blank, I'm out. It's a non-negotiable. It's a mm-hmm. non-starter. I am completely mm-hmm. done with that. Encourage what it could look like for those that would be willing to put themselves in this position and have the opportunity to heal and grow with their partner.
That's such a wonderful question, because this is not an easy black and white, I find this out and I'm out of here, because there's so many factors involved, right? How long they've been together, how many children they have, you know, financially, where do we stand as far as financial security? And so you're right. I typically find that if we've got a partner who really loves their spouse, they don't want the relationship to end. And so the betrayed partner, they'll take extraordinary measures and steps to try to keep this connection. So the pro-dependency is really based, like you mentioned earlier, in this attachment approach. So what we'll do is we'll start focusing on, okay, how do we repair the disconnection? How do we repair that relational trauma? And at the same time, how do we also create healthy connection? And so it's going to take, and this is the part that gets a little discouraging for my clients, mm-hmm. is that sometimes that repair takes anywhere from, you know, 3 to 5 years.
Wow.
That's the reality of recovery from, you know, this type of an addiction. Now, that doesn't mean that the partner is going to always feel bad through that. I oftentimes see within 6 to 12 months that I've got this betrayed partner who's much more grounded. They're finally feeling a little more connected, you know, with their spouse again. The spouse is in recovery, their addicted spouse, rather. And so they're starting to feel more secure.
I appreciate you taking the time to thoughtfully answer these questions in a way that sort of demystifies the process, which can be such mm-hmm. a, like you said, when someone finds themselves in this position, it's a trauma response, and it does seem overwhelming. But hearing you go through the different steps and explain it and what is possible, I think really helps people who may be listening think that it's an actual doable process, you know, and I'm sure mm-hmm. that a lot of your initial conversations have a lot to do with this kind of hope and encouragement in a time when we're all trying to strengthen our connections with others. What do you hope that people take away from this idea of the pro dependency and this concept and how it can positively affect their relationships?
Well, what I like about it is, like we'd mentioned earlier, it's really based on attachment. And so when we have this severe, you know, attachment wounding that occurs with an addiction, what I like about the pro-dependence approach is that it's all about how do we reconnect in a healthy way. To me, there's a lot more hope in this. Mm-hmm. Rather than pointing fingers at the partner and saying, oh, well, you know, your spouse is an addict because you're doing this, this, or this. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So we're really pursuing in this process, how do I create healthy, intimate attachments? So I've had this addicted partner, right, who's connecting and attaching to pornography or, you know, what other sexual behaviors outside the relationship they are. So how do we get them into a space, the addict, where they understand healthy attachment, but at the same time, I'm also assisting the partner in creating healthy attachment. And so we're working continually on this ongoing interpersonal connections that take place. And so, yeah, we acknowledge that, hey, you've done this, you've tried this, maybe it wasn't the best way. Let's just review this and see if there's a better way to create connection. And I am finding that with my clients that they stabilize so much quicker, knowing that, hey, what you're doing is your best attempt at trying to connect with your partner because you love them. Not that, hey, you're broken, and because you're broken, you keep making mistakes. So I think that's one of the best takeaways, is that I'm giving these partners of these porn and sex addicts a lot of hope. And at the same time, you know, their partners, those that have the addictions, are working on their own healing. And it's really wonderful to start to see this transformation take place in the process, hope, right? Because we're promoting the sense of attachment.
Yeah, hope and healing in a situation that often feels just so damaging and so hopeless. We've been visiting with Debbie McRae, who is a licensed psychotherapist and sex addiction counselor. She specializes in working with women who have experienced trauma as a result of their partner's sexual and pornography addictions. To learn more, and there is so much more to be able to learn and to discuss about this conversation, you can go to familystrategies.org. Debbie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
As the weather starts to warm up, are you wondering where to start with your spring garden? Well, we're going to get you ready. That's coming up in 20 minutes.
I'm hoping that I can inspire you to check those hiding places where you put gifts. You know, you have to hide them from the kids.
Yeah.
Hiding there could be a $660,000 gift. That happened to one family. I'll tell you about that coming up in your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Are you getting ready to revamp your garden this spring? In 20 minutes, we're going to tell you what you need to make sure you're doing to so your plants will thrive the entire year. Oh, but first, right here, we've got your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online right now, and Lisa and others who follow sports very closely.
You know my love of sports ball.
I just want to apologize because you likely know about these first two stories,
it's okay,
but they
I'll
are
allow
still,
it.
In fact, trending online. The Utah Jazz over the weekend set a brand new NBA record by knocking down 18 three-pointers in the first half of their game Saturday night against the Orlando Magic, now previously held by the Golden State Warriors. I just want to put this in perspective and do some quick math on the radio.
Yeah.
18 three-pointers, boop, boop, beep, boop, boop, 54 points in the first half.
Wow.
The Utah Jazz went on to win as they started recruiting people from the stands to come play in the second half of the game. You want to play in an NBA game, they said, and just started bringing... No, not actually. Major League Baseball announced on Friday that they're moving the All-Star Game, which was supposed to play in Atlanta, Georgia. They moved it because of concerns about its potential to restrict voting access to people of color because of a new Georgia law. A new location for the All-Star Game festivities have not yet been announced, but they are likely to be announced this week. And then finally this, you've done this before. I don't have to ask you. I would have to ask you how many times you have done this before.
So many
but
times.
But you get the gift for the kids or spouse and you hide it because you know. You know they're going to be looking for it.
Well, you buy something on sale off season to save money, so you've got to store it for a while.
Well, what happened was, if you can travel back to 1986 when this individual bought an original Super Mario Brothers cartridge game, right?
Oh, yeah.
Complete with a little hanging thing so you can put it up on the rack, right?
Oh, wow.
A pristine condition Super Mario Brothers, never been opened. Well, they found it and said, hey, I bet this is probably worth something. Quickly went to the internet to find that they could get more money than maybe they thought. Took it to a heritage auction where someone paid $660,000 for an original Super Mario Brothers cartridge. It makes me wish I could go back in time and hide all the gifts I got when I was a kid and be like, how much are they worth now? The greatest investment I could have done. So look in those nooks and crannies. You never know.
No,
it may
don't.
Not be $660,000, but it might be some really like stale candy or something.
It could be something.
Yeah, it could definitely.
You know, it's that idea of where you put $10 in your winter coat so that when you go through it, you find it or whatever. Now I can see you doing that. You're going to just buy gifts.
Yeah.
Who are these for? No one.
Yeah,
it's our retirement. And you're going to hide it now, aren't you?
Just tuck it in the walls and then drywall over it. And then that'll be that's my retirement plan.
Good idea. There we go.
And that's also your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T.
I have to ask you, Lisa Valentine Clark.
Yeah.
People give you a lot of advice in your life. People lean into your life, whisper things into your life and say, you know what you really should do?
Uh-huh. You know what you ought to do?
Is that received well by you? The unsolicited. Is the unsolicited received well by you?
I don't think anyone likes being told what they should do. But there are a few individuals where if they tell me to do something now, I have enough age and wisdom behind me to go, yeah, I need to think about that or consider that. I call it the case of the shoulda, coulda, wouldas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what you should have, you know what you could do. Mm. You know what you would have done would have gone a lot better. And it just depends. But I think it's interesting. We do live in a society where a lot of advice freely flows, freely given.
So then I would be curious, as I take that one step further, are there pieces of advice that throughout your life, your 31 years on this earth, that have circled back multiple times where you've thought,
that's
been suggested, but I still haven't done it. But I bet there is something to that particular thing.
Oh, yeah.
So I would be curious if you would be willing to share one of those things.
I think one of the biggest ones, and it's interesting because I've talked to my brothers and sisters about this several times, is running, right?
Okay.
So my whole life, like my dad was he ran marathons. I had a lot of friends in track and in, cross country and stuff. So my whole life, people were like, you should run.
Mm-hmm.
Get some it's so great. It's really great mentally, physically.
Being outdoors, it'll change your life. You get a lot of air in your lungs.
Yeah. Do that. It's so great. And I finally took the advice, probably about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's been maybe even a little bit less, and started doing it. And all the benefits that everybody had said for, how many years, I just was like, I like this. Oh, I love this. I should have done this earlier is the second thing that you say after you find something that you love. And it's kind of like, when people tell you over and over, like different people from different walks of life through different phases of your life say it, and then you finally do it, you're like, oh, I should have done this earlier.
Mm.
And it's funny because, I talk about this with my brothers and sisters all the time of like, I mean, what would it have been like if we started this in high school? Like, just think how good we would have been by now how fast we would be
You could have been an Olympian. Lisa, you could have been an Olympian marathon runner.
But, so that's just the first example that comes to mind.
Okay, I want to share one with you. Is it running? Yes. Darn it, you took mine. I want you to travel back. This is going to be a little bit of a story, but I want you to know. Yeah. I want you to travel back to a young 13-year-old. He was Rick at the time. He wasn't Richie.
Poor Rick.
Was diagnosed with the opportunity to have braces for several years. Hey, you're going to need these for a while, the orthodontist said. And I said, okay. Now, proper dental hygiene was something that I had always practiced. You wake up, you brush your teeth.
Yeah.
You go to bed at night, you brush your teeth, but always along the way encouraged to floss, especially when you have braces they're just traps. They're just food traps waiting to happen. Well, at the time I was 13, 14, 15, 16 as well.
Oh, dear.
I had braces all of that time. And every time I would go to the orthodontist, you know, you sort of meet with the, like, the assistant who does sort of the cleaning and changes the thing. And then the orthodontist comes in and says, great, and then goes to the next room. I was encouraged to get a water pick.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't need a water pick.
No. Yeah.
That seems like
technology.
That seems like an accessory on my sink. Even as a young teenager, I was like, that seems like a thing I don't want to. And, you know, back then, the water pick, you had to, like, fill the reservoir, and you probably had to take that bucket out to the pump to fill it. That's what it felt like. It felt like too much to me.
Yeah.
And there was a hose and a plug, and I just was like, I can't do it. I'm not going to do
that. For a 13-year-old.
So then let's flash forward to, like, a young 23, and at this point, I've developed into the Richie, not the Richie we know and love today, but I am at least at that
Rick
point.
You went from Rick to Richie. Yeah. It was a transformation.
You will now call me Richie. And I went back to the dentist, and it had been a few years since I'd been at the dentist, and let's just say I had cavities multiple that needed to be filled at the dentist. And they said, hey, you know what? We're really concerned about your proper, you know, dental hygiene. Are you doing all the things that
What's
you were supposed
what
to?
They
and,
were saying.
And I said, well, you know, I'm trying the best that I can. And they said, well, you need to make sure you brush, and you need to make sure that you floss.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever tried using a water pick before? And again, my mind, almost in a PTSD fashion, triggered back to the time I was 13 with braces on my teeth and thinking, I don't even know what a water pick works.
It's too much.
Am I from a family of opportunity where we could even have a water pick? Is this even an option?
You couldn't even dream about a water pick.
They fixed my teeth. And I went on my way. By the way, I could have bought a car and said I had my teeth fixed in that particular visit. Over the years,
you've had some. I think it bears an interrupting your story for just a second to say you've had a lot of issues with your teeth and your mouth. It's not just that you're not brushing. You are.
It is genetic.
It's genetic.
Yeah. And sometime in my life, some improper care. In fact, though, I will say this. My particular dentist, he is a good friend of mine. I went to his father before him, and now he's sort of followed in the family business.
Yeah, you put him through school.
He allowed me. No, I'm not joking. There is at my dental office a placard that I had made. It's called the Richie T Wing part
Stop
of his
it.
Office because I feel like I've paid for that much of his office. And he's a good sport. He let me put it up. I'm like, are we doing this procedure in the Richie T Wing? And they're like, oh, that's who this is. It's very funny. Anyway, I digress. I recently went to the dentist after yet another problem. I got sat down. They were able to do the procedure. And at the end, the assistant said, hey, I'm going to go ahead and floss these through, but I want to ask you something.
No.
And I thought, are you going to ask me about a water pick? And she said, have you ever considered using a water pick before? And I said, you know what? I'm going to go buy one today just so I don't have to wonder.
The fanciest, most expensive water pick.
So now can I tell you about this? So it is a wireless water pick with a reservoir in the handle. It is like the Cadillac of water picks, hashtag not sponsored. It is the greatest thing
you love
ever.
It?
Oh, my gosh. If you've never used a water pick, and I know everyone who's had braces is like, yeah, dummy, we had these when I was, it is the most amazing invention for dental hygiene maybe ever created, but certainly in my lifetime.
You're a believer.
Yeah. And you know the best part? Aside from you don't have to do the floss between the fingers and all the things. I mean, you should still probably do that a little bit. But for the most part, the water gets in there and swishes it around. You know the best part about it?
What?
Really cool water gun to shoot your spouse with.
Okay.
Babe, check out my... Ow, come on. Right in the eye like a like the old clown in the squirty flower. The water pick is the greatest thing ever. And I wish I could go back to 13-year-old Rick and say,
Rick,
believe in yourself, Rick. Believe in yourself enough to know that you deserve a water pick.
You have a case of the shoulda, coulda, wouldas, and you did it. Oh, man. Well, you know, now that you have it, now, what else are you going to try now that you previously would have never considered?
I'm not sure exactly.
Is this changing? Is this opening the door?
I am not sure what I'm going to lean into next, but I have the courage of the lion from the Wizard of Oz. I do not know what's going to stop me next.
You know, I think the rest of the day I'm going to think, what are people always telling me? You know, you know, you oughta. Yeah. Have you ever thought?
Good point.
Like, what else are we missing out on?
As we bring this around to everyone, I think we ask ourselves the very serious question, what are the water picks in your life?
Now, do you think about your mistakes from your garden year to year, make the same ones? Well, coming up, we're going to find out what we can avoid if we want to make our garden the best this year. That's coming up next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
The frost is melting. The weather's getting warmer. The sun's starting to come out. Spring, dare I say it, has sprung.
I mean, to be fair, the sun has always come out.
Okay.
I don't want to. I mean, the sun has kind of always been there.
We don't want to make outrageous claims.
It's getting a little warmer, but the sun, it will come out tomorrow.
Settle down. But what if you are looking around, right? You're looking around at your yard and you're thinking, I really want to have a garden. Is now the time? What if you've never gardened before? You've never planted? How do you even start? Where do you find plants? Or where are the best plants for your home's climate or soil? How do you even find out? Well, here to help us answer all these questions and more is friend of the show, Carrie Ann Rhodes. Welcome, Carrie Ann.
Thank you. Good morning, friends.
Good morning, friend. In my mind, I have you wearing farmer coveralls morning as you're chatting with us. Am I accurate?
Really cute boots.
You nailed it.
And a straw hat with a piece of wheat hanging out of your mouth.
That's right. How did you know? It's like I'm there.
Well, we do know that you have thought about this, that you've already probably mapped out your garden. And as we are just surveying our own individual situations, I mean, where do we even start? Do we start with the plants? Do we start with the timing of it all?
Well, it helps if you make a plan. So we start with a plan. And I mean, you haven't been fantasizing all winter long about what you're going to do to your yard.
I just know it's going to require a lot of raking and cutting and picking things up.
It does. It requires a little bit of work, and how much work you want to do is totally up to you. We'll talk about that. The level of work you want in your garden, the level of like formality, the water use, you know, all of that is really up to you. And so part of the fun of making a garden, as is the fun of like planning a home or decorating a home, is the fun of making the plans. The fun of kind of looking and seeing what's out there. And so, for me, that's fun to make a plan with a garden, the same as a home technically, but it takes a lot more patience with a garden, is to think a few years ahead. I know that's hard.
Oh yeah. That is kind of hard. Why should we look a few years ahead instead of like just looking from season to season? What's the benefit?
The benefit is, things take time to grow, and especially to kind of fill in and become big. I think I've told you guys before that the house that we live in, when I saw it for the first time, I walked into the backyard to a fully mature green wall of beauty. And in the summertime, the foliage around my yard is so big and mature that I can't see other houses. And I was benefiting from someone else's planning and someone else's years of kind of like taking care of this yard. And so if that's what you want, you kind of think about, well, what do I want in a yard? What do I want it to be? You kind of have to imagine a few years into the future and then kind of plan for that. There are very few people who can afford like a full a fully landscaped yard of mature plants kind of all at once. And so we kind of have to do it in sections. And so obviously the first section you might think of is the front yard, right? That's, that's the part that you will see constantly as you come and go from your home. It's what your neighbors see. It's what your, you know, in-laws see as they come visit. So, I would start with the front yard and, make a plan for the types of plants that you want, how big that you want them, but then also kind of where you want them. And again, talking about your budget, it may not be possible for you to have this kind of like, you know, fantasy garden. So, maybe start with containers, right? Like container planting and maybe planting in groups because a drip system, watering system is a lot more economic in terms of money and water than, say, like digging sprinklers. I mean, who likes to deal with, you know, full-on sprinklers every spring, turning them on, finding all the broken ones? I mean, that's everyone's least favorite part of spring, right? We want to get right to the plants.
I mean, well, I mean, I like to find and run through the broken sprinklers, you know, the pipe bursting out of the, I put my bathing suit on and run around, but I know I'm in the minority as far as that goes.
That's very positive of you. I like that spit.
So it's an interesting approach. When we were talking about spring gardening, I guess my mind sort of went to the idea of like what I would be eating in the fall. Not necessarily like the planting of like shrubs and hedges and things like that. So the very first thing as we kind of climb out of winter is it the man we want to see what we can hope and look forward to in the summertime? Are we like what as we break out of spring and are getting our hands into the earth? What's the consideration that we have?
I think adding things like vegetables and herbs into your regular foliage type, you know, flowers or shrubs is kind of a fun way to do both. Some people don't have really great like garden space. They may have a very shady yard or they may have, you know, just don't have the means to kind of create both. And so a fun way to be thinking about that, Richie, about like, well, I want to eat things is how can you incorporate those kinds of things into, you know, the plants that are going to kind of fill your yard and make it look beautiful. And you can do that in beds. So last year in my front flower garden, I grew herbs alongside flowering.
Oh, what a great idea.
And even right by my front door where my kind of, you know, prettiest quote unquote flowers are, I had a pepper plant and I had a eggplant plant. And eggplants are beautiful plants in and of themselves. They produce the most beautiful little flowers, and then you get these lovely purple eggplants. And so consider kind of pairing your vegetables with your flowers, and you kind of save space, and you kind of get, you know, extra. So, you know, think about what you can plant together to get those tomatoes, right, by the end of the summer, along with your dahlias and your pretty thing.
What a great idea. I think when a lot of people are planning out their garden, whether it's just decorative or useful, you know, to eat, that mixture of perennials and annuals can kind of like trip people up of like, what do I need to nurture that so I don't have to keep buying plants every year? And what do I just plant for color? How do you make that sort of decision?
I kind of leave room for both. As a frugal gardener, you know, I don't have a huge budget every year to kind of make my flowers or whatever I'm doing. I can't just reinvent it every year. So I really tried to go for as many perennials as I can, but I've come to accept that there is money well spent in the colorful annuals. So the bulk of my flower portion of my garden is perennials, things that I can count on to come back every year. And as they come back, they're better each year, right? They're a little bit more established. There's definite advantage to having the perennials, but you cannot beat things like the petunias or the marigolds, those types of annuals that are just pure color and joy. So I save room. I save room in between some of the perennials and save room along the front to be a border. That's a great place for your annuals, is to be kind of a colorful border to whatever you're doing. So there's natural ways to kind of use those and plan for them. And gardening sites will certainly help you plan. Like, here's the best place to put those annuals for, like, the most bang for your buck, or, you know, here's how you can get the most out of your perennials coming back every year. So definitely rely on the experts. You find your favorite nursery, find your favorite website for plants, and that'll definitely help you plan where they should go, so you can, you know, get a lot of color, get a lot of produce, get a lot of whatever this summer. I'm in the right place.
We're talking with friend of the show, Carrie Ann Rhodes, about spring gardening, both the the vegetable garden, those things that we would eat, and also just those colors that we would enjoy. And I think it's interesting, as you've sort of turned the conversation toward the professionals that would be able to help us, there's also those people who, they see gardens, whether they be on Instagram or in a magazine, and they think, I would love that in front of my house, only you live in a tundra zone, or you live somewhere where those things can't grow. Let's turn a little bit of the conversation to that. How do we know what we can even grow where we live?
Our world, the gardeners of the world, have and the experts have divided our country, at least, up into zones of growability. So it depends on how far north or south you live. Your elevation makes a big difference too as to what will kind of grow well. And so any gardening website will help you understand what zone you live in. And then as you go to a nursery, even if you just go to the hardware store or even the grocery store, they sell flowers, you know, fresh plantable flowers. You can check the little tags that come with those flowers, and it'll help you understand, okay, this is this zone. It tells you how to take care of it. Tells you what kind of sunlight or the amount of sunlight or shade, and the watering. So that kind of helps you, like, actually read those tags. Sometimes I've been known just, oh, that's pretty, I'm going to plant it.
Yeah,
and then I wonder why it's not, you know, thriving in my yard. So do just a teeny, teeny, tiny bit of research, and that will help you. There are certain things that I would love to grow in my yard that just will not grow in the area that I live in. Like, I cannot have a lemon tree planted outside.
Yeah.
But someday I might. Someday I might live in the right zone to have, you know,
with
all
global
my citrus
warming, you could. One day with
you
global
never know.
Warming, maybe.
So as we, you know, look at, over our yard and we're starting this planning, we know where to go, we're asking the experts. I'd love to get your perspective on the actual soil. You mentioned earlier that it depends on what zone you live in and things like that. But are there certain things that we can do, no matter where we live, to make sure that our soil is rich and nutrient-filled for our little seeds or plants?
Yes. The sad reality is that most yards and most kind of newer homes are filled with terrible dirt. I mean, garbage dirt, right? Yeah. Like, it has tons of rocks in it. They're not giving us dirt in our yards thinking about planting or about gardens or anything like that. Like, builders want to build you a house. There's enough dirt on there so grass can cling to. but if you would like to get into gardening, you're going to have to bring in dirt. It's just kind of a reality. But here's the deal. You are in control of how much dirt comes into your yard. So if you're serious about creating some really beautiful beds, or like maybe even garden boxes, you can build those boxes and add that good dirt into them, rather than trying to like get these plants to eke out an existence in the dirt that you have. So how much dirt depends on what you want to make. Do you want full garden boxes? Do you want to do this kind of in like pots and containers, you know, kind of grouped? But you want to make sure that you've got some good topsoil. And that is something that you can get from, often your city will have some kind of like, what do they call it? A place where they sell mulch.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
or
sure.
Different types of soil. And you can go, you know, borrow someone's pickup truck, or, you know, find some containers and go and fill them up and bring them into your yard. This can be really expensive if you need a lot of dirt. It's less expensive if you're doing containers. And then find somewhere where you can buy some compost. And some people compost themselves in their yard, and that's great. That's a terrific way to get nutrients into your soil. Or you can purchase it. We've even been known, when we lived in a certain neighborhood, we had a goat farmer that had horses, cows, and goats, and they would donate some of their manure to neighbors who wanted it. You just had to come get it yourself. And it's a win-win situation. We were getting nutrients for our garden, and the farmer was getting rid of his, you know, giant pile of poop. So maybe find someone in which you can do a a nice trade. Here's a loaf of bread. Can I have some of your manure?
I will trade my bread for your manure. There's something to that.
There
so,
is.
Carrie-Anne, I would be curious. We only have about a minute left with you. What's the thing that you're super excited to be growing this year, whether plant or vegetable?
Oh, our complete focus has changed from having like a variety of things, like, oh, we want this and this and this, has just become, Todd, how much room can we dedicate to your tomatoes so that you can make homemade salsa that will sustain us the entire winter?
You're focusing
that
in. I like that intention.
Focus. Yep. He's the farmer and he's the canner, and all we want is salsa.
All right. So you're doing some heirlooms. You got some heirlooms?
Oh.
Are you already doing your starts right now?
Yes, we do. We have a nice variety of like tomatoes to eat and tomatoes to can. And I am a fan. The Mr. Stripey heirloom tomato is my favorite eating tomato.
You guys, I don't even have a favorite eating tomato.
Well,
I don't even have a favorite tomato.
So, sometime when Lisa's not around, we'll talk about the Cherokee tomato. Carrie-Anne,
I have so much to learn.
We got to make sure we keep her included here. Carrie-Anne Rhodes, friend of the show. If you want to be able to see the gardens that she is seeing and be able to follow along anytime that she's on the show, you can go to Carrie on the Lisa Show on Instagram. There's lots of underscores between each of those words. It's Carrie on the Lisa Show, underscore between each of those words. Find and follow her today. Why don't you?
My objective is to not get discouraged before I start.
Yeah. Yes. And get a nice pair of gloves.
Oh, I like that.
That's a pro tip.
Okay. A nice pair of gloves so that I can find my favorite tomato. Now, are you nostalgic? Is it hurting or helping you? Well, coming up next, we're going to tell you whether or not nostalgia is making your life any better.
I used to be nostalgic. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Yeah, you make my life better.
Everything I need in the morning.
It's my favorite show ever.
They keep it fun in the morning.
I love you guys.
Welcome to The Lisa Show. I'm Lisa Valentine Clark.
And I am Richie T.
Do you wish you had the budget to renovate your home? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how you can revamp your fixer-upper without breaking the bank.
Passive aggression in song. We look to the Major League Baseball team, the Oakland Athletics, and tip our hat to them. I'll tell you what we're talking about coming up in your morning buzz. Here on The Lisa Show, we love to start your week off with a little bit of hope, a little bit of feel goods. We call it Tell Me Something Good.
Tell me something good.
Now, I have to tell you, if you are not following The Lisa Show on Facebook, you need to do so.
Yeah, do it right now.
Because there is a video that complements my Tell Me Something Good. You can find it there. And please go ahead and do so. This is... I'm trying to think about the best way to kind of couch this.
Yeah.
You know how sometimes you'll say something sort of as an off comment, you know, your mama bear heart, you know, this hurts my mama bear heart, or my mama bear heart sort of reaches out to that.
Or they said this and my mama bear came
watch out.
Well,
this is a literal mama bear.
Oh.
And mama bears, as I learned in the process of being ready to tell you about this story, they typically only have two or three cubs at a time. In fact, three would be a lot.
Uh-huh.
So you can probably relate to that kind of mama bear. This particular mama bear has four bear cubs.
Oh, wow.
And, well, they're on one side of a busy highway, And they need to get to the other side of the busy highway. And so traffic has stopped. And one of the little baby cubs is like, yeah, mom's going across the street. I'm right behind you, mom. I got this. I'm with you. And then mama bear has to come back and get another one of the cubs. Well, the first mama bear cub then follows mama back to the other side of
well,
the road.
That's what you do. Yeah, you follow mom.
I'm with mom, right? It is every family dynamic played out by mama bear and bear cubs on this road as they make their way across the street to the point, I mean, spoiler, they get there. But tell me, every mom, as you watch that video, have you not felt like that mama bear trying to get four bear cubs across the road? Does my heart good.
Oh, I love that.
To all the mama bears out there, go check it out. You can find it on the Lisa Show's Facebook page. And that is your Tell Me Something Good.
Thanks, Richie T. Now, it's been more than a year since the world's been changed forever. And with that, it's easy to reminisce of a time when you could go outside without a mask and you could spend some time with your family without being worried about getting sick or getting someone else sick. Feeling nostalgic for a time before COVID is normal, but is it beneficial for us or just adding to our anxiety? I've spent some time thinking about this, actually, when people say, imagine a time, or do you remember? I think, is this helping us to inspire us and propel us to move forward, or is it kind of holding us back and creating a sense of almost dread? And how can we deal with that kind of nostalgia in a way that's healthy and productive? It's an interesting idea, and I think that we should bring into our conversation to answer these kinds of questions, psychologist Art Markman. Welcome.
Hey, it's great to be here.
We're glad that you're here. This idea, I think, that we all can relate to of just sort of reliving the past. Is that nostalgia, or does it add another element to it?
Well, I mean, there are lots of times when we remember the past, and so just remembering the past isn't necessarily nostalgia. Mm-hmm. Really, nostalgia is when we're looking back on something, and we often get a little twinge of you know, sort of happy sadness, right? Where it's, you know, it's probably sometimes it's a fond memory, but it's also the past, and so you've got to have that little bit of pain with it for it to really be nostalgia rather than just a memory of something that happened.
Why does it happen, or what triggers it? You know, I'm just thinking about the difference between just having a memory and that feeling of nostalgia.
Yeah, so there's some interesting research on this, and it turns out that when you are spontaneously feeling nostalgic, mm-hmm. it tends to be because you're feeling a little down already. And you know, you're thinking, well, the future isn't so bright for me, or there's just some things going on in the present. And so you look back on the past and you tend to remember things that are consistent with that mood, and it drags you down a little bit. And so often I think when we try to escape from our present, it's because we're not so happy with it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that all nostalgia is bad. If you actually ask people, hey, think back to a time when you in your past that makes you feel a little nostalgic, you often then actually remember better things. You tend to remember more positive things, you know, a game of catch with your parents or you know, going to a play or, you know, something that you did when you were younger that is actually a happier event.
Would it also be the floodgate for what we in our household lovingly call those times of spiral, where you sort of open it up and you're like, oh, yeah, I feel that. Oh, no, I feel this a lot. I feel this so much more.
Yeah, you can definitely end up in that kind of spiral of living, you know, thinking, well, the past is just better than the present. Things are not never going to be as good as they were. And, you know, you have to kind of snap yourself out of that at some point and say, you know what, actually, when times are bad for us, they're never as bad as they seem in the moment. And frankly, when things feel good, they're never quite as good as they seem either.
Are there benefits to being nostalgic?
You know, I think it's important for us to remember where we came from and to remember the path that we took to get us where we are. You know, our personal histories matter a lot. They don't determine who we are, but it's often useful to remember obstacles we've overcome, to remember and to remember good times, to remember those people who've helped you in your life. I mean, there a lot of times when we're feeling sad on a given day, we feel a little bit more alone than on other days. And sometimes it's useful to look back to those days when you were in your family's loving embrace or in in some other situation among friends that actually demonstrates to you that you're not a solitary person.
We're talking with Art Markman about nostalgia, and I want to get very specific about it because a lot of the country in the next month and a half is going to find themselves in a similar situation that they were over a year ago, that being that we're coming out of the pandemic. But things are in fact different, so there will be a lot of time, at least brief moments of nostalgia. What can we do to empower ourselves to make this a successful time rather than spending it spinning?
One of the things you have to do is to remember that we're entering a new normal right now. So this seems to be
Hey Art, we're gonna put you on hold real quick and try and get reconnected with you.
We're having a hard time hearing you.
You're getting a little staticky, so we'll have our folks try and reconnect on that end. You know, it's a thing for me as I think about kind of coming out of this, because where we live, like the government mandated mask mandate ends this weekend.
People are getting vaccinated at a high rate. Yeah, we're starting to look and see the light at the end of the tunnel.
But as Art mentions, you know, we're coming into a time where we are in a new normal. So we will be in familiar settings, but it won't feel the same. So I'm curious as to how, you know, once we find ourselves in these situations, what that will be like and kind of the emotional part of, yeah, we're back to normal, but this doesn't feel normal.
Feel the same way. Yeah, that is the consideration that I wouldn't say nervous about or anxious about, but maybe just it's on the top of my mind as far as that feeling of, well, it was better back then, and remember this. And I want to have those conversations where I feel like it's going to be useful information to make things easier and not worse and not dreading. I think we have Art back. Are you there?
I hope so.
Okay, good. Thanks. You sound so much better. We've been just talking about this idea of nostalgia and how we can use it for our benefit. A lot of people say nostalgia it combats loneliness. Have you found in your research that that's true? And if so, how can we move forward and use it in the best way?
Yeah, I think the best thing for us to do is not to dwell on the things in the past that probably are going to be a little bit better than they are, particularly if we think right now as we exit the pandemic. We really want to focus on reclaiming some of the things that we used to be able to do that we want to do now, and to really be focused on what are the positive actions that we can take. You know, one of the things about humans is we have a tremendous ability to frame the way that we think about things. So we can choose to focus on the positive or the negative elements of things, and I think the more that we choose to focus on our opportunities that are in front of us rather than the limitations, the more that we feel like we have some agency, some ability to actually affect the future in positive ways.
Richie kind of hinted to this earlier, but it is recommended that you don't really, really dwell on things, right?
Yeah.
For a while.
Both personally recommended and...
I'm sorry to laugh, but I've been guilty of this as well. But some things make you nostalgic for a long time, right? And I'm wondering if we find ourselves sort of caught in a moment like that how we sort of shake ourselves out of it. Like, you know, it wasn't like, is it one of those cases where you say, well, it wasn't all that great, or, you know, it wasn't, it seems to be kind of rewriting history, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. There's a certain amount of revisionist history in our lives. You know, one of the things that happens with nostalgia is you look back on the past and you know how things turned out afterwards, right? So, I mean, people will look back on high school or college or early in their career, for example, and think, you know, it just seemed like such a simpler time. But it was pretty chaotic in all those times. I mean, when you're in high school, you don't know what's going to happen next. Are you going to go to college? Where are you going to get in? You know, in college, am I going to get a job? Early in your career, am I going to do well? You know, now that bit's been written already. So all that uncertainty that you felt about the future has evaporated because you know the plot already.
And you know, it's sort of like watching a movie that you've seen before. You know how it's going to end, so it's not quite as fraught. And I think that we, you know, one of the things we need to do is to recognize that every phase of our lives has a little bit of uncertainty as we move into the future, and that's okay. We should embrace that and use that as an opportunity to write that future, and not to be anxious about the fact that there are some things that we can't necessarily control.
As you work with clients or patients, the idea of being all right with uncertainty sounds frightening. How do you help kind of, you know, buoy up or secure those folks that because of the pandemic, their sort of foundations have been shaken and now trying to move forward, they're just looking for any kind of hope of certainty?
Yeah, I think we have to work on the idea that you really never know how things are going to turn out. All you can do is to prepare yourself, right? So I think one of the benefits of things like nostalgia is actually the opportunity to look back on some of the things you did and to actually plan a little bit, to use those to say, well, here's how I handled the situation that I was dealing with in the past, and then to say, okay, so how much of that can I use now to be able to move forward, to be ready for some of the things that are going to happen? I mean, I think that, you know, you can treat uncertainty as frightening, or you can just say, look, I just need to be ready for some of the things that are going to come in the future. And I know, because I've gotten myself to where I am right now, that I can handle those things and that I will find a way to deal with whatever comes up.
It seems that the buzzword when we talk about this kind of issue is that resiliency, right? That, you know, yeah. We've faced hard things in the past, so no matter what happens in the future, you know, we can face it. We're gritty. We are resilient. Obviously, we want to encourage those around us to have that perspective, you know, when we're having conversations with our friends and family and they're feeling, you know, nostalgic about a certain time. What is useful to sort of help buoy people up and what's not useful?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's useful is to really look at and to find what are your sources of energy to do things off into the future. I think that one of the things that can happen when things are uncertain and when you're looking back and thinking, well, the past is going to be better than anything in the future, is it can actually sap your energy to actually want to engage and to do things off into the future. And so, you know, a lot of what you want to do in life is to find what I like to call bridgeable gaps. You know, there's something you don't have right now that you'd like to have, but you really feel like you know how to go after it and how to get it. You want to find some actions you can take today that will get you on the road towards the future that you want. I think when you feel like you're on a path and you have some energy to do that, then you feel better about life, even though the future is uncertain. And it's when you don't have a plan, you don't have any actions you can take, when you feel like you're being buffeted by all of life's currents, that then you feel like, well, it doesn't really matter what I do. And so you really do want to focus on what can I do today that gets me one small step towards where I'd like to be tomorrow.
Art Markman, I'm excited for a future day when Lisa and I are sitting around and we're feeling nostalgic about when we had you on the show to give us such great information about nostalgia as we came out of the COVID pandemic. Art Markman is a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. You can learn more about Art and his work by going online to smartthinkingbook.com.
How do you renovate your home while sticking to a tight budget? Well, coming up, we've got your answers.
When you want to get in and under the skin of your opposing team, you play a little Carrie Underwood.
What?
I'll tell you what this is all about. Coming up in your morning buzz, you're listening to The Lisa Show.
Welcome back to The Lisa Show. Is the return of spring pollen putting a damper on your mental health? Hey, in 20 minutes, we're going to tell you about the small things you can do every day for better overall wellness. But first, we've got your morning buzz with Richie T.
It's three things that are trending online, things that folks are talking about. Shall we celebrate a holiday today?
Always.
How about National Bell Bottom Day?
Hey, now. No, I'm not wearing
it. No, you're not. What?
clam diggers? What are those called?
Well, they're just a
pantaloon? Is it a pantaloon?
Yeah, I'm wearing pantaloons.
A bloomers?
Yep, that's exactly. Oh,
I'm painting a radio picture right there. It
you
is
in fashion.
National Bell. Listen, we know of the two of us. Which one of us knows more about fashion? We'll just leave that there. National Bell Bottom Day today. So consider wearing the bell bottom pants.
Yeah.
You know why they're called bell bottom?
Because they look like a bell.
They flare out like
bottom.
A bell on the bottom. Do you know when they first originated in fashion?
60s?
No.
70s?
The early 19th century.
Oh.
Is when it started to get a little flare. Take that to your pantaloons, Lisa Valentine Clark. It also came about with sailors in the U.S. Navy. That's how it likely became a little bit more ahoy hoy, a lot more popular. As well as in the 70s, Sonny and Cher on their television show would rock the bell bottoms. And then people went, we like those two. We will do that. Also, a sporting competition that I feel like you can get behind is happening over on Verzuz. This is Verzuz. It's an online website where people pit things like Earth, Wind, and Fire versus the Isley Brothers.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
And they go song for song, round for round, who would win? And they do it with all sorts of great artists. That's what's trending right now.
Cool.
The Isley Brothers versus Earth, Wind, and Fire. Hot take. Who do you take?
Earth, Wind, Fire.
Okay.
I don't know.
You're a fool. You know why?
I don't know.
Shout by the Isley Brothers brings down the house every single time. Now, if you're starting out a competition, you go September, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Yeah.
But I digress. Yeah. Speaking of songs, we go to the final. You know, we opened up baseball just this last weekend.
Yeah.
You know, the wood
sports ball,
the ball,
yeah, it's
stadium,
the ball with the top
a lot
top
of
stitch.
a lot of stadiums. Thank you for noting. Yeah. A lot of stadiums open up to fans, and if you recall in the past, the Houston Astros not only accused but proved that they were cheating at the baseball.
Well, we don't like that.
A couple of people fired, a couple of people penalized, but for the most part, people would tell you that the Astros got off pretty easy for what they were doing.
Yeah.
Well, the Oakland Athletics, that's in California, they were playing the Houston Astros, and they decided to get just one more dig in on the Houston Astros. And so when the Astros were introducing their starting lineup for the baseball game for the opening day of 21 season, they played Carrie Underwood's Before He Cheats as loud as possible as they introduced the starting lineup of the Houston Astros.
That doesn't seem very sportsmanlike.
Is it rude or really hilarious passive aggression in a baseball stadium?
Okay,
you decide. I'm not going to be the one to tell you. You decide what it is. One thing it is for sure is your morning buzz.
Thanks, Richie T. While some people like the idea of buying a finished home with all the updated amenities so that they can just enjoy it, others get excited about the idea of fixing up a rundown piece of property. I think that when I was younger, the idea of, I'm scrappy, I don't have any money, but like I can do it myself. And now that I'm a little older, I'm like, it's going to take so much more money and time to fix it up myself. But maybe not. I don't know. I miss that sort of that scrappy spirit.
The thing that I love about anytime you do a do-it-yourself project, whether it's you're renovating a complete home like you would see on a TV show, or you're just fixing the door that didn't quite shut properly, is I like the memories that are created within it. Most of the time, because for me, as I try and do one of those do-it-yourself activities, I don't do it right the first, second, or third time.
You got lots of memories.
So the frustrations and the just laughing, the ability to laugh at myself, how I did it so poorly, because once I finally get it done, I sit there and go, you know what I should have done, and I'm able to laugh at myself that way.
Well, and unfortunately, the home renovation dreams come at a cost more than just having to do it over and over again. On average, home renovations can cost anywhere from $19,000 to $73,000, with the median sitting right around $40,000. And most people can expect to pay anywhere from $15 to $60 per square foot in renovations. So
What do you do if you're just on a tight budget and you have no other choice? How can you make your home renovation a reality without breaking the bank? Well, here to enter this conversation with us is do-it-yourself home renovation design blogger Ursula Carmona to teach us about how she achieved her dream home on a budget. Well, welcome, Ursula. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, first of all, I want to go through your thought process and start the conversation there. Why did you just choose to do all the home renovations yourself instead of hiring someone else?
Well, I think there are those times, like you mentioned, in your life when maybe you're on a budget and you want this beautiful space for your family, but you just, it's nowhere in the finances.
Yeah, it's just not even an option, right?
No, it just isn't. And there are those who want to have that. Maybe they can't hire things out. Maybe they can't have a contractor and do major renos. Maybe they can't have a designer come into their house and do it. So then I want them to know that they have that option, that they can do a lot themselves.
Okay, so you want them to feel like they can do it. So what are those real tips and tricks that help you actually save money?
Well, I mean, for every space, I think that the goal is to create a space that you love and that works really well for your family. So one of the things I always recommend is don't bite off more than you can chew at one time. Everybody thinks, oh, look at all these fantastic HGTV shows, et cetera, or, you know, other renovation shows out there, and they want the immediate before and after shot. And I'm like, hey, wait a minute. It's a process. You know, things take time. Things take money, so don't be afraid to let it be a process and take your time doing it. You know, tackle a room that maybe bothers you the most, or little things like paint. Paint is something that you can do in an afternoon, and it doesn't have to be huge, but it can make a big impact. So little bite-sized pieces here and there is the first suggestion that I always give people.
But here's where I push back. I think, well, while I've got the paint out,
yeah, since I'm already
doing
it,
as well pop off the baseboards, or I might as well. I mean, while we're in this mess, and so
don't
things
fall
can
down the rabbit hole.
I know. This is what happens in reality, though, right?
It does. I know it. You look at one space, you've got it done, and then the next thing you know, you're like, oh my goodness, that looks dingy over here, and you've got, you know, 10 different unfinished projects going on at the same time, which could be a disaster. So I always recommend for those who are, you know, kind of new at it, ease your way in. Take on a small project, finish it completely. Nobody wants to live with a half-done project or remodel for the next 3 years. That's just a disaster.
Ursula, can I tell you a story?
I
live in a 100-year-old home, and I purchased it, and it had been one owner in that entire time, and they had not really spent any sort of time to renovate it. And I, probably like you, am a fan of the HG television shows that would let you know, hey, what you do is you start the renovation project, and within a half an hour, your home will be exactly how you like it, and everything will be just absolutely perfect. Now, you can probably understand the folly of my way, but we live in a culture where certainly people will preach, well, you know, the way you make money is real estate. Renovate, flip, you know, you should start doing that. But we don't share the struggle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think that, you know, everything worth doing comes with a cost, right? Everything worth doing,
yeah,
it takes effort. You're going to go through some pain. Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to pretend like it's a magic wand and poof, everything is perfect.
Right.
But I love the idea that you come out the other end of it with a space that is uniquely yours. You can be proud that you got your hands dirty and got into it. And then it works and functions the way that your family works and functions. So that, to me, is priceless.
Okay, so Ursula Carmona, you're a DIY design blogger. We want to learn from your mistakes. So we're talking about the inspiration. You know, that's one thing about why we should do it. It's another thing to, like, dive in. So give us a little bit of extra confidence by sharing some of maybe some tips on saving on construction supplies or where to go to get the best prices.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Budget renovations are the best because, I mean, as opposed to you know, doing everything from scratch. So that does take more time, but I love to go to thrift type stores that might have old pieces of furniture that you can work into the design of your space. I did some built-ins in my closet, which I shared on my blog, Home Made by Carmona. And in the middle of it, I put in an existing chest of drawers that I painted and added to look like the rest of the built-in. So it kind of made the process a little easier, but it also made it cheaper because, again, this was a thrifted item that I found for 10 bucks. Nobody else wanted it. You brought it home. You zhuzhed it up a little bit, and it works in the space. You can also find some amazing, you know, budget things, even at your local hardware store. I think people don't think about things like maybe looking in the oops section. I like to call it the oops section of, you know, various hardware stores where you've got, you know, pieces of wood that was cut to the wrong size or paint that was mixed incorrectly or that somebody didn't want, and they're significantly marked down. You've got, you know, some places have thrift stores like the Habitat for Humanity Restore in the States, for example, that have, you know, projects from other people's renovations that they no longer want. So there's a lot of ways you can do it. I remember when I was first starting out, my kids and I saw somebody was renovating their kitchen and they dumped a whole slew of cabinets on the sidewalk. And we took their little cart, their little and a stroller, and we walked up there and we hauled those things all the way down the street. And let me tell you, they made the best basement built-ins you could ever imagine.
Huh.
Wow. You know, you've hit on something that that I want to give a little bit more attention to. I think, and this will maybe speak volumes as to how I sort of perceive the world, but when I think of a do-it-yourselfer, a do-it-yourselfer blogger especially, I think of, you know, the single woman or the young couple with no kids, and she's got a wall of fedoras and various patterns. You know what I'm saying? Like, I sort of have this perception of who it is that's doing this, but you have mentioned multiple times that you are able to accomplish this with kids in multiples.
Yeah,
how do you do that?
Mind-blowing.
You know, I think that you take on what you can. And, you know, it's funny. I always say that there's nothing that's more motivating than desire, right? So wanting to create a beautiful space for my kids, but not having the budget when they were younger, it was just something I did. You make things happen when you want it to happen, right?
Is it a valuable lesson for your kids to be learning alongside of you? Or do you say, all right, guys, mom's doing this. This is where you get your screen time. A little extra screen time. We're fixing the bathroom.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, So I'm a huge fan of the idea of doing things as a family whenever you can. I mean, that's not always going to be the case, but I have, as my kids have, you know, grown up through it. They're teenagers now, by the way. I've got three daughters. I started doing a lot of this when they were really little. So there were some projects I had to, you know, for safety, set the kids aside and then, you know, do my thing. But there are a lot of projects that I could also include them in. That way they could learn to be a little more independent, a little more handy. Because let me tell you, home ownership is one of those things when you start to see things break down around you, you better get handy quickly.
Yeah,
so
no
I want to start them young, you know?
Well, and to give them this sense of power, like, oh, yeah, I can figure this out, even if I don't know how to do it, and learn these kinds of skills. Now, hopefully, by listening to this conversation, a lot of us are feeling a little bit more empowered, right, and a little bit more like, hey, you know, I could do one thing. If someone is looking at a huge project, noticing a lot of things that need to be fixed in their house, where do you suggest they start?
Well, you know, I think it's individual for every person, right? It's a very personal thing, but you have to start where your skill level is and then just go ahead and keep pushing that. That's what I do. So I may have started and it may have been just as simple, like I said, as paint a wall. And maybe that's something that's, you know, new or unique for me. Maybe it's not. Maybe I'm ready to tackle some built-ins or hang a new light fixture, you know? But I say that you start small and then just continue to increase your skills by trying new things and stepping outside of your comfort zone. Because the great thing about these things is it's not something that's final. the little mistakes that are going to be made, and they will be made,
yeah.
they're fixable. So don't sweat it. Just go ahead and don't be afraid to get your hands a little dirty.
I don't know what's happening right now, but my mind is kind of racing and I'm thinking, you know, I've got this bathroom that needs to be renovated. It needs, you know, and I'm thinking, well, maybe I could do just like the baseboards first, or maybe I could do resurface the walls, or could I? Replumb and replace a sink? I don't know. Maybe. Whereas this morning I would have said, no, there's yeah. no way.
Well, you know, again, I think it's the little things. And the beauty of it is it doesn't have to be huge to make a big difference. Well, I mean, it could be the small things. I replaced in my bathroom. I wasn't ready to, before I was ready to take on a whole plumbing job, I said, you know what? I'm going to just replace the countertops. And I bought some that were already fitted to the size. And wouldn't you know it, I painted the cabinet out. I put a new top on it. And it looks like new. It looks like something I purchased for the space. So small steps.
Yeah, it really is those small wins that sort of instill the confidence for us to do greater things. If we can take this sort of metaphorically, right, like anything, we have to do those very basic steps to be able to renovate wherever our lives may be.
I like where you did. This is pretty
That's
deep.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Who knew we were going to get life lessons from Ursula Carmona?
I did. Oh. I knew in my bones.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ursula, for those that are really considering this, they've been within the walls of their home and thinking, you know what, we can't buy a new place, but it is time. The weather is changing. We can do some of these bigger adjustments. Give them the encouragement to take that step toward doing it themselves as they renovate a portion of their home.
Oh, yeah. I love that they are. This is the time, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think that if we've learned anything over the past year, people being home, working from home, it's that your spaces matter. It's that you can create not just a beautiful space that looks nice to look at, but we're talking about that functions well for your family. And that should be the goal. So if something isn't working for you and the lifestyle you want your family to have, then don't be afraid to go ahead and make that a priority to say, hey, you know what? We're going to change things around just enough to make us comfortable, to make this a haven for me, for mine, and for the people that I hope to bring into it.
Now, Ursula, people can get you all over the place. Where do you recommend that if they want to be trained and inspired by you, where would you lead them?
Well, I am always trying to share some new DIY tips, tricks, renovation ideas, and most of that I love Instagram. I'm at Home Made by Carmona, and the last name Carmona, Carmona, and you can find me on Instagram or you can find me on Facebook, and then there's always the website, which is homemadebycarmona.com.
Ursula Carmona, thank you for being on the show with us.
Next up, we're going to discuss the small things we can do that are going to make a huge impact on our mental health, things that work. That's next.
You're listening to The Lisa Show. Welcome back to The Lisa Show.
When speaking about our mental health, we often focus on tools like therapy, right? Mm. Meditation, medication. And those are all great things to help us feel our happiest and our healthiest. But what are some of the small things that you do to feel good?
Run. I run.
Yeah, me too.
It is a treadmill. Even if it's just 10 minutes where I can just get the heart rate up a little bit, noticeably different, and walking my dog is something that I do now more for my mental health than I ever have before. Part of that because I didn't have a dog before, but also part of that just because it gets me out. It gets me away from my phone. It gets me out of my neighborhood seeing people. I also like to see kind of the neighborhood in the different seasons. And for some reason, as seasons change, it makes me inner reflective as I, you know, go, oh, am I changing too? It's time for a change. It's time to revamp some of that stuff.
I can't run inside. Running outside is my jam. And I feel so much better when I do.
And that's part of it, too. And one tactic that you haven't really said, which I'm actually surprised about, is gardening.
Oh, sure, sure. Getting my hands in the earth.
Because you're really good at it.
Oh, well, thank you.
Well, you know, you. In fact, for those who aren't familiar, Richie has shared on the show about how he's not only turned his own yard into a garden, but actually stole. I don't want to say stolen.
No,
well,
I'm
going to.
No, I just
I just
farmed other people's lands. That's
your
all it
neighbor's
is.
Plot of land and started gardening on
they,
there.
They had better sun over there.
So there's something to it. We talk about gardening a good amount on the show, but we're going to focus our conversation on the emotional benefits of it. And we want to invite into the conversation, you know, with real with real science facts, you know, the benefits of gardening. Our friend of the show, therapist and author, John Sovic. Thanks for being here, John.
Good morning. And I, too, have a big, beautiful, radiant garden in the front of my house. And then out back, I have this hillside that's just kind of like the wild foresty zone, and that's where the dogs get owned. They get to play back there.
Oh, that's nice, though. Is that something that you did consciously? Like, I'm going to garden and cultivate this land for my, you know, emotional, mental health? Or was it just something that you've always done?
It's actually something that I've always done. Even when I'm in a house now and we're on a good sized piece of land, so we have lots of room to do stuff. Mm-hmm. But even when I was apartment living, I always had something growing out on the balcony or the porch, whether it was just putting in some basil or putting in a pot of tomatoes or going to the garden center and just getting some flowers and having a pot of flowers. I've always had some type of gardening around my world.
So about the gardening, is it being outside or is it working with our hands that has the emotional benefit?
It's that and all kinds of different things. I mean, we get outside, we put on our sunscreen and our big hats, but we're still getting some vitamin D, which is really great for our bodies. We're gardening, we're raising our heart rate a little bit, we're breathing a little bit deeper. We're drawing all of these like wonderful energies into ourselves. And the thing that I love, I don't know if you saw this a few years ago, there was this really beautiful coverage of this technique that they use in Japanese culture called green bathing. And it's really just about going out into a forest and just like walking through a forest and being in all that greenness. Well, that same thing happens when we spend our time with our plants in our garden and just let that unnameable energy that the garden carries, Richie, you know what I'm talking about, just kind of infiltrate us and just make us feel good.
I love that. I'm wondering for those who have never even tried it and who are thinking, well, I'm just not good at it or, you know.
Too much. It's too much to learn.
It's too much. Yeah, it's an entire – it's a different language in a lot of ways. I'm wondering if maybe hearing some of those specific benefits of what it is mentally that can help will help them sort of maybe give it a try. When you talk to your different clients, do you talk about the benefits of having an activity like gardening?
I do. And just let me geek out for a moment. This is my neuroscience side. It's just something that fascinates me.
I love it.
Let's do it.
And so when we get anxious bodies, we fill up with cortisol, adrenaline, and our bodies get shaky and they get anxious and they get tight and we feel our shoulders rising up. And there have been myriad studies that look at the fact that simply by being in the garden, digging your hands in the dirt, you know, picking flowers, even just having plants around if they're indoor plants, like helps release serotonin and dopamine, those feel-good chemicals. And I really like to educate my clients on how these plants can affect their physiology. And then I have them do experiments. One thing that I do with a lot of people who are going through depression is say, well, what if you just every week committed to yourself to bring fresh flowers into the house? Just to have that energy there and just see how it makes you feel. And almost all times when clients follow through with this exercise, they report feeling better. Simply the idea of having something natural there, spoiling themselves, taking care of themselves, taking care of the flowers, all of those things help lift their energy. And once again, that is a chemical response of the serotonin and the dopamine coming in and washing through and getting rid of those anxiety chemicals. So if you take that on a bigger scale and step out into a garden, you're going to be surrounded by all of these things that are going to stimulate your mental and emotional well-being.
John, I have to tell you, as we've been visiting, John Sovek talking about springing into wellness and about gardening, I picture you sitting down with a client in sort of the typical therapist room, and you've heard your client out, and you're giving all sorts of advice, and then you sort of turn around, and in the spirit of what we know about doctors or therapists, with the prescription of, like, take two of these, I imagine you grabbing two plants, like tomato plants in your hand, and turning around and saying, take two of these.
And take care of
them. And plant them in the morning, and just giving that idea. Yeah, do some people push back and be like, no, I came for you for real science, for real, you know, talking through, and what does this really do? Or do most people accept this as, I'm willing to give anything a try?
Well, I would just say this, because as a therapist, I'm also a yoga teacher, a meditation teacher, I teach mindfulness techniques. So the clients that work with me know that I'm going to be working a little bit outside the box as it is. So if I give you a prescription of two tulip bulbs, soil, and water, go for it. People are at least willing to do what I call an experiment. I never give it as homework, but it's like, let's try an experiment. What if, you know, when you saw this plant, you just actually bought it and took care of it? And like I shared with you, I sometimes go into the neuroscience side of it, so they get an idea of why I might be suggesting it. And there's a certain playfulness that I bring into this work, and I think it's really important when we're working on our mental health to not, it doesn't have to be all like serious all the time.
I love that. I think that's encouraging. Do you have any stories that you feel comfortable sharing about how gardening's helped maybe one of your patients or yourself?
Well, I'll use myself. I think it's always a good place to tell the story from. So I had a period probably about 25 years ago now where I actually went through a really serious depression. It was to the point where actually getting up out of bed felt like an impossibility every morning for myself. And in the apartment that I was in at that time, there was a back area that was a shared area, and there were a bunch of empty pots out there. And for some reason, I started thinking about back when I was a kid and like growing carrots. Don't ask me why it was carrots, but I thought about it. Mm-hmm. But I also knew growing carrots didn't work real well. So I decided something easy. I mentioned basil earlier. You put in basil seeds, they sprout up, they go like crazy. And I decided I just wanted to create an herb garden for myself. And it was a thing that helped me get out of bed and go out and just put some soil in a few pots and then use my fingers to put the seeds in. And then every day I would get up and I would have to water it. And then as it started growing, I was so like fascinated by watching them sprout and grow. And then eventually I got to use those herbs to make food for myself. But it gave me something outside of myself to take care of. And I really credit that as part of my, you know, recovery, along with my own therapist and friends and, you know, a lot of internal work. But just the process of being able to take care of something else and be part of its growing cycle really helped me to move through my depression.
Wow. I appreciate that.
This seems like too simple. Does that make sense? Like, to me, it just seems like this maybe makes sense. Just so simply makes sense to me. Maybe it's because of where I come from and having...
I was going to say, that's an interesting... And I just only want to, like, interrupt you just to say that to me, it doesn't seem simple. To me, it seems like a lot of work. So that's interesting that you would say that.
So is it based on your experience? Because you don't know this, John, but we like to joke around here that Lisa has two black thumbs.
Like, I try, but I don't. I'm not good at
She's
it.
She's able to kill most anything.
Yeah.
We haven't been able to...
With not a lot of effort.
Yeah.
Pretty maybe good that, at it. Maybe, I'm pretty
maybe
good
that's
at
part
it.
Of it. Is there that detrimental part where, like, I would say this simple, Lisa would say that this is hard, but if someone finds themselves experimenting with this, doesn't have a great experience, that it could just...
I still kind of like it, though.
Yeah, but just have a greater impact of like, oh, yeah, you weren't able to do this, and having the reverse effect of the therapy with the plants. Does that make sense? Am I making sense?
Well, no, but Richie, I think you're a fellow gardener. You'll get this. One of the things that's really magical about being your gardener is the absolute unpredictability of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, let's say one year you planted tulips and they came up like, oh, they were so amazing. They took over the garden and you took pictures. And it was all over your social media and a display. And the next year you plant the same tulip bulb and it comes up mediocre at best. And that's what's so really kind of cool about gardening as well, is as much as we want to think we're in control of our lives and the world, that gardens gives us the lesson that we're not always in control. And it's really powerful as a gardener to sometimes just let go of it. You know, I'm standing here in my living room looking at my garden right now as we're speaking, and we have these big, huge lavenders that last year did nothing, and this year they've taken over the garden. I don't know what's different. I took care of them as best I could. But that unpredictability, that really willingness as a gardener to let go of control, I think also is really powerful for our mental well-being.
Yeah, I like that component because it is freeing to say, well, sometimes it is based on your skill and sometimes it's not. And it's a metaphor for life and how things turn out, right? I mean, it certainly makes me laugh, but there is something in a collective effort, too, in trying to decide, you know, what it is that you're going, what it is you want to get out of gardening, right? And being outside and just working on that, there is something, you know, sort of magical about it that I think we can all relate to.
Well, and you won't use the word collective, and that's another big thing that's great for mental health, is community-based gardening is so wonderful and powerful as a way to bring communities together. I know all over Pasadena and Los Angeles and almost every community that I've traveled to, and I travel a lot, is like have community-based gardens. And people come together and they take care of their little like 6-foot square plot of land. But then they're like, oh, I grew eggplants and, you know, I grew lemons. Let's exchange. And there's this beautiful community connective piece that comes with gardening as well, too. I just mentioned my garden. Just not too long ago, about 7 years ago, it was mostly like dried up lawn and a horrible dead hedge. Took it all out, put in a really beautiful native drought-tolerant garden. It's luscious and beautiful and full. And it has become a place where people stop by. And they'll be like, oh, wow, your garden's so beautiful and inspired. And people have taken cuttings from my garden. And if you walk up and down my block, you will see plants from my garden in about half the houses on my block.
Wow. Cool.
And it has become this like community connection. And I think that's just another one of those beautiful benefits, whether you're, you know, doing a community garden plot or you're sharing from your own garden. They bring people together.
Yeah.
John Sovek, a therapist and gardener, joining us here on the show. I just want to go and be home in my garden.
I know. Doesn't it make you start thinking about it?
Take some pictures and share clippings with people. They'll be like, we didn't want these. And I'll be like, put them in your yard. I was inspired.
That's called aggressive gardening. That's a different segment. But yes.
I will make a community here. We will do this. I'm following John's example. You can find more about John online, johnsovek.com, or you can follow him on Twitter, @JohnSovek. John, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, and good gardening, everybody.
Well, you're online, hop over to the Lisa Show's Facebook and Instagram, where you can see pictures and an incomplete recipe for a cake. I love that you had talked about. Describe this cake for people.
Okay, so it's a coconut cake. It's really delicious. Enjoyed it yesterday. Basically, it's a cold cake. You know, like it's better the next day when you put it in the refrigerator. But it's coconut in the cake, in the frosting, with coconut on the sides. It's really great.
And it's made to look like a nest of sorts, and you put kind of eggs in the middle on the top.
You can put those Cadbury eggs on the top, so it looks like, the coconut is sort of a messy nest. Listen, it's springtime. You want to eat coconut and chocolate.
So we shared that over the weekend.
Yes.
And my favorite was people are like, I am inspired. These pictures look great. I can't wait to make this. And then there's sort of the list of the ingredients. And I'm like, okay, I'm on board. And then I'm not sure if on our end we didn't share something or if there's a missing piece in my brain in order to be able to make this cake. But it's sort of with the directions that we gave people, it's sort of like, have ingredients. Now you have a cake.
Yeah.
There was a missing piece of it. And I know I'm not the only one because several people
mix everything together.
Several people reached out over the weekend and were like, this looks great. I'm inspired. I have the ingredients. Missing piece, you guys.
I love it though.
I want to make this cake.
I love the interactive quality of it. I'm like, wait, what? And then we're like, oh, yeah, just mix it all together and then bake it. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Baking it. That was the thing. It's not as good if it doesn't set up an actual cake form. I just have a platter full of batter at home that I should have baked.
Well, I don't know.
I like to mix it up because sometimes I make cupcakes, you know, out of it. It just depends on how much time you have and how quickly you want to eat it. If you want to do the 8-inch round. Anyway, I like those recipes that can be adaptable. So maybe this one was a little too adaptable. Either way, make some coconut cake today.
Also, I heard of a recipe over the weekend that I wanted to share with you because as we both know, we are, in fact, a cookie show.
Yeah.
Bold move.
Yeah.
We've talked about the Reese's Easter eggs and also the Cadbury eggs, which pro tip, now on sale 50% at your grocery store because it's the day after Easter.
Good reminder.
Load up. Take those. Smash them with a hammer.
Okay.
Very therapeutic if things have been rough coming out of the pandemic. Very therapeutic. And then take those bits and pieces of the Reese's peanut butter eggs. Mm-hmm. Not the soft ones. I'm talking hard shell. The Cadbury eggs. Mix them together in all their bits and pieces and use those instead of chocolate chips in your chocolate chip cookie recipe.
Instead of or in addition to.
Did I say instead of? I meant... In addition to.
That's a great pro tip.
And then stop by your doctor's office for an insulin shot because
that's not how diabetes works. But I will say I think it's really generous and funny that you think there would be leftover Cadbury eggs and Reese's eggs.
Well, they're 50% off at the store today.
True.
Get your decorations and your sugar fix for the rest of the
week. What a great pro tip. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app. Where you're listening on demand. You can also find us on Sirius XM, channel 143.
You want more pro tips? A pocket full of pro tips? Subscribe to The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts and listen whenever you want.
On tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about the habits that are going to guarantee that your kids can handle anything that life throws at them.
Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.